Here we are kicking off a new quarter, a new study, the Gospel of John. This will be a little different than I have done in the past. It won't be so topical, but we'll try to chase some rabbits and do some things. This will be an interesting study for us. I don't feel like I'm very qualified, actually. With some of the men in the congregation, I may be the least qualified to be studying this and trying to take it to some kind of level that maybe we haven't heard in a while. We'll try to look at everything. It is hard, like I've said before, in a class like this, in a class this size, we try to teach to every level, and we have such a broad spectrum. I don't want to take anything for granted about what we know, what we don't know, and so we will talk about some of the elementary things of John and some of the Gospels, as well as trying to dive into maybe a little bit of a higher level of scholastic study. John is very different. John is a gospel that is very different. It is not one of the synoptic gospels. The synoptic gospels being Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Synoptic being the same. It looks the same. It sounds very same. John's is very different. It is written from a different perspective, but interesting enough, one from the inner circle and has a perspective that is very unique, and yet it melds in and harmonizes with those gospels very well. But we are going to find out that we know a lot of things about the first century, about Jesus, about his ministry, and we know those only from the book of John. And I think it might surprise you some of the things that we take for granted that we know that only John tells us, and the other synoptic gospels come short. John is a different book in that it starts very differently. It starts at a different time, a different place. We have it broken up. We'll kind of go through that, and we'll tell you the divisions of John, and so that you can kind of get that in your mind. And as we go through chapter by chapter, he has a very different style. We could probably go through, if you have a red letter edition to your Bible, there will be more red letters in the book of John than the other Gospels. They talk about the incidents. They talk about situations. They talk about parables and parabolic sayings and things like that. But we do not have the rich dialogue in any of the other books except for the book of John. John was probably written late, maybe one of the last books of the New Testament, close to the end anyway, towards the 90s, maybe the early 90s. John may have been very well by tradition there, has him in Ephesus when he writes the book. We'll talk about that and why we think those things. John's book is different in that it tries to bring out certain things, and one of the major themes, obviously, is in John 20, 30, and 31, when John tells you that these things are written. Many other things did Jesus in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book, but these things are written. Why? That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that believing, you may have life in his name. And that will be a major theme in John. He will talk about light and life and Jesus being the life of those who believe. You know, years ago when I was flying over Iraq in an A-10, I remember looking down towards these cities in An-Nasiriyah or, you know, Baghdad or something, and you couldn't help but to think. I thought, well, is there somebody down there searching for truth? I think maybe I've told the story before, but I think it's a good introduction to John. I couldn't help but to just notice these massive cities and the devil's lie that just, you know, they haven't been able to extricate themselves from about 600 AD or so from the devil's lie. And I thought, is there somebody down there who's actually searching for truth? At that very time, apparently there was, and so it's years later, I heard a man speak who talked about the fact that he grew up in Baghdad. He was going to Baghdad University, and he began to question the teachings of Islam. He began to question a doctrine that was called a doctrine of love, and yet all he saw was hatred and killing. And so he began to search around, and he got into a class that had world religions. He thought it was very interesting how little they touched on Christianity and how they painted it with such a vivid and bad picture. And he thought, well, that just can't seem to be true. I don't hear about it that way as much. So in clandestine fashion, he began to go through the markets and he began to look for an illegal copy of the Bible. He came upon a manuscript that was sold to him at night by a marketeer on the outskirts of Baghdad, and it was said to be the Bible. So he took this book and he went back and he read it. He was somewhat shocked. This book didn't have anything in it about the stories that he was told about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It had nothing about the creation really in it. It had nothing about all the things that Jesus was have said to have done and said. But the book hooked him, and it was intriguing because it talked about Jesus in such a different fashion than Muhammad, because they were supposed to be, of course, just great prophets. Jesus was this just a great prophet, a good man, and then, of course, Muhammad really had the last revelation in his mind. But this book just intrigued him, and he began to study more and read it more, and then that's when he found that he didn't have the Bible at all. He had the Gospel of John. And it was the Gospel of John that spurred him on and encouraged him to continue to study to the point where he was using the internet then to try to reach out to sites and hit missionary sites and hit some of the Bible sites that we have here that were got on the internet. And he began to study more and more about the Bible. By that time, his family knew that he was in trouble. They begin to talk to him. They begin to bring in his uncles and his aunts to try to talk him out of this craziness and this idea that he had that maybe Muhammad wasn't a real prophet at all, and maybe that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God. After a while, the imams, local imams, did come to his door. They found him with much material. They came out and they took him out at night. They threatened him, tried to scare him a little bit, roughed him up some. But he was known, he was a student at the university, so they let him go, and he went back, began to live his life. That's about the time he got a hold of one of our missionaries in England. That individual actually flew over to the Middle East, flew into Baghdad under pretense of some kind of special business. He was baptized in a large jacuzzi tub in one of the local hotels, and that missionary left him with some material and departed. He then had to flee for his life after a while, and it took him years to get out of Iraq. It was some of our conquest over there in 03 that enabled him to slip out and finally depart the area. He came over here on a tour. He was talking, and he actually spoke at a church that we used to worship with up in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. But I say that because John's gospel is that way for all of us. It is a book of belief for the unbeliever. It is a book of conviction for the Christian who thinks they know who Jesus Christ is. It is a book that makes you want to delve more into really the personality of Jesus, more so than the other Gospels. And that's why John was written. Very interesting, different styles and different things that John does bring out. We find that the Gospel here, the authorship, has been in question for some years by the critics. Although around 180 A.D. or so, you may even be surprised if you never thought about this. John never puts his pen onto the pages with a signature. He doesn't say, my name is John, I wrote this. He doesn't say this is the gospel according to John or anything like that. Those things have been added. So as you read through the gospel of John, it does not have a signature, much like the book of Hebrews. It doesn't have a signature of actually who wrote that. So why do we come up with those things and say that John wrote this book? Internally, we have some pretty good evidence. We know that the book was probably written by somebody that was very close on the inner circle. But there's a very interesting expression in the book of John, which is the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's found in John four times. We have those on the screen, 13 and 23. As you know, in chapter 13 of John, this is the Last Supper. There is a low table in an upper room where these men are reclining, lying with one elbow on the ground, now taking up the Roman and the Greek culture rather than the Hebrew fashion of sitting with crossed legs at a higher table. They are now leaning and reclining upon one another. Much like their Jewish culture, those that would be closest to Jesus are those that had higher prominence in the group. It's hard for us to think in those terms, but it was easy for them to naturally fall into that, and I would even argue that we do that today in American culture. There is one that leans up against his breast. Peter then would turn to him and say, who is it? He's asking the question, who is going to betray him? And this disciple whom Jesus loved leans back up against his breast and asked, who is it? That is one of those places, very conspicuous, I would say, to call a particular disciple again and again. So John never names himself throughout the book. The second place is in John 19 and 26. We know there is the crucifixion. There's a very interesting occurrence here as Jesus is naked on the cross, shredded, beaten, about to give up the spirit. He looks out, and then, of course, he sees his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved. And he saith unto his mother, "Woman, behold thy son." And then to the disciple whom he loved, John, he says, "Behold thy mother." You know, critics have come to us all the time and said that Jesus must not have had the brothers and sisters that we're going to read about in John chapter 7. Because why would he hand his mother and her care off to someone else? But you know, Jesus is thinking and knowing all things. I would ask you to remember a couple of things. He was closer to John at this point than he is to his own brothers. His brothers are unbelieving. I'll talk about that in a second. There will be a destruction, the likes that Jerusalem has never seen in 70 AD. And his brothers, some of them will already have been martyred and killed by 70 AD. And she would then be cast off. As well as having to leave Jerusalem or having to leave Galilee and this dispersion going on, maybe he felt like she would be safer with an apostle who dies when? Last of all. That he would be able to take care of her for a long time to come. In chapter 20, in verse 2, we see scene of the resurrection. And who, of course, he appears to first? A woman, Mary of Magdala. Something that you and I wouldn't have written. The Jews certainly wouldn't have written that because her witness is not credible. As a woman, she could not have testified in court against a man. She would have not have been thought as a real credible witness to the beginning of a church or a kingdom in this world, and yet Jesus chooses the woman of low degree, the first one to say the five words that changed the history of the world. I have seen the Lord. Mary runs back, first of all, knowing that the tomb is empty. She runs back and she sees there and begins to visit and says to Peter, Simon Peter, and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. In chapter 21 and 7, we read the Sea of Tiberias, Sea of Galilee, or Gennesaret, depending upon what time period. The disciples are fishing, and that disciple, therefore, whom Jesus loved, saith unto Peter, "It is the Lord." What does Peter do here? The impetuous Peter, he jumps out of the boat and he swims over to the shore. Even though the boat is not that far off the shore, it does have a net full of fishes that is hard to navigate now and has kind of encumbered the boat. Ask yourself this along with some other questions. The Peter has jumped into the water and has gone to the shore. In the dialogue and the witness of this apostle, whomever wrote this book, it begins, the narrative begins where? When the boat arrives at the shore. You see, it could not have been Peter. It could not have been Peter, and it's most likely not Peter, because we find Peter in the third person in dialogue with a different perspective of somebody else listening and watching and writing these things. Peter goes up. We do not know what happened. But by the time the boat gets there and John gets there, Peter is already sitting there with a coal of fire with the Lord and they're cooking fish. And yet we don't know anything that happened in between that period. We must surmise that the writer of John is in the inner circle. Now, who is the inner circle and why do I say that? There may be a lot of things that we accept about the Gospels and the things that you're told. Why do we say there's an inner circle? Inside the 12 apostles, there's an inner circle. Who was on the Mount of Transfiguration? That's right. There's only three that he took with him. Peter, James, and John. Who did he take further into the Garden of Gethsemane in his hour of anguish? Only three. Peter, James, and John. It happens again and again. It's easy to discern from all of the gospel accounts that there's an inner circle. It's Peter, James, and John. It's not Peter because Peter is referred to again and again in the third person with this dialogue. Is it James that wrote this book? He was in the inner circle. Could he have written this book? Could we have been bought off on maybe a tradition of the church where this is really the gospel of James? James is killed in Acts chapter 12. Acts chapter 12 brings us to about what year do you think? Maybe 44, if you have a study Bible there. Herod kills him. Herod actually dies shortly thereafter, probably by the finger of God, right? And that's in 44. Why do we not think this book was written in 44? I'll give you a couple of things right now. This book doesn't say anything about the destruction of Jerusalem. This is the only book that is written to Jews that somehow presupposes that they don't quite understand what was going on in the temple, what the feasts were, what was happening around Judaism. Can you imagine? People, if this book was written in 44, those people would not have had been explained to them what was going on in the Jewish world. By 70 AD, the door shuts. God's judgment comes down, steps on Judaism once and for all, stamps it out. The people are spread all over, and in less than half a lifetime, they have forgotten all of their traditions and things that were written. There, they've got a mishmash of the synagogues, the Pharisaism, all of these other things coming in. And John's a writer that comes up in a late date and begins to insert things explaining what was going on in the first 40 years of the first century. Isn't that interesting? And yet he's writing to a Hebrew audience. And so that would be one reason that we think and take the late date of the gospel, and because it was so different than the others, because of the purpose and the developed conflict and those that were disbelievers by the time 90 AD comes along. At least that's our thoughts and guess. It could have been earlier. We're not sure. None of these things are actually written. He didn't see himself. See, that's a perfect example why Peter, again and again, if you just read those passages, he's not the witness of these things. There's a great, great argument made by B.F. Westcott in his commentary, and he starts from the general, and he says the individual that wrote the book of John was a Jew. Then he says the person that wrote this book was a Jew in Palestine. He was very familiar with Jerusalem and the temple and the workings of the Sanhedrin and all of these things. And then he was an eyewitness to the events that he speaks of. And he even says that where? When he's closing it out in the epilogue in John chapter 21, 24 and 25. And this is a disciple that has witnessed these things. I've seen them. And I've written these things, and we know that his witness is true. And many other things that Jesus did, if we were to write every one of them in the books, they would fill the world. So we know that it was inner circle. We know that it was a Jew familiar with these things. In fact, he will say phrases and things as we try to go through the textual study. I will show you how offhandedly he will speak of the Feast of the Dedication and things that the other Gospels don't do. He was very familiar with what was happening. He was a Jew's Jew on the very inside of the Hebrew tradition. And that is the person that wrote this book. Now, we look at other evidence. I'm not a textual scholar, so we'd have to get Terry Edwards a gift for somebody in here. But they will all tell you this. If you lay up the language and the style of 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, if you lay that up against this book, it has the same author. It's the same author. It's the same one. The same vocabulary, the same themes, the same explicit things about the light, and the light was the life of men. Same kind of thing. So we can rest assured that this is written by John the Apostle. Somewhere close towards the end of the century. And it gives us perspective on the Gospels that none of the other Gospels do. And certainly the personality of Jesus. We've talked about the date and why we think it is. Internal evidence points that way. about the destruction of Jerusalem. The critics on this are just like any of the others. The German theologians that had come along in the 17th, 18th century, they really begin to pound away at this. Why would they late date books like Daniel or even John? Because they come from an assumption that says there is no such thing as the inspired writer. These aren't inspired, these are witnesses. But as theological thought and eschatology developed throughout the first century, we're going to try to date books with how developed is that idea. And so they come along arbitrarily and say, well, we're going to place it pretty late because this is a very developed eschatology. So this is second century. And that's exactly what they were pounding away in the universities, in the divinity schools, up until the year 1930. What happened in 1935 that made them seem somewhat silly? A 3-inch by 5-inch manuscript, a papyrus that goes back to about cataloged as number 67 or so, I think. This is chapter 18 of your Bible, the book of John. This is the trial that Jesus has before Pilate. People, this is dated at 125 in the most liberal fashion and towards the close of the first century in conservative circles. But it's not outside of that. As one writer would almost exaggerate, and he would say, this was actually copied when the ink was wet where John wrote the original manuscript. That's how old this fragment is. This book was not a second century manufacture. It's not in the quiver of arrows of the critic of the Bible. The John Ryland's University fragment. The teachings of John. We're gonna group this into three main themes here. You have the claims, Jesus' claims, you have his signs, and you have his manhood. Jesus makes claims here that he doesn't make in other places. This is the most pronounced, the clearest that we have about who he is. Once I was arguing with a Mormon individual, and I don't apologize for that at all, but he told me, he says, first of all, he's a little surprised that I knew the Mormon religion like I did. I'd grown up in Arizona. I knew that they had taught that God had relations with a goddess and that Jesus was their offspring. Yes, sir. Does it sound somewhat mythological, somewhat Greek to you? Somewhat pagan. That's why you're not taught that when you first go into the Mormon church. That's one of those advanced teachings. And I said, how could that be when Jesus was eternal? Well, the Mormons argued with me on that. They said, what do you mean he was eternal? Where do you think I turned to in the books of the Bible? I went to the prologue of John. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God, and the Word was with God. And the same was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. And not anything that hath been made was made without him. Not one thing. And that phrase, in the beginning, as we'll go through later, when we go through the textual look, we'll ask you the question, what is the beginning? What's the beginning he's talking about? And I'm going to tell you from this perspective now, it does not matter where you date it. If you say he's talking about the creation, fine. Jesus was already in existence. If you're talking about some time before that, fine. Jesus was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. Was meaning he was existing. That's tough to get yourself out of. And so then they came up and said, well, who said that just because someone's eternal, that defines God? And I thought, wow. I guess we'll just go wherever this discussion takes us. The claims of Jesus in here are most explicit and most vivid than any of the other books. C.S. Lewis would ask this question. You know who he is. He's a great writer. He's a great, I need to read more of him. I told Ashlyn one of these days in great books, hopefully Faulkner would get around to C.S. Lewis instead of Plato, but when they do that, I'm going to read those books. But C.S. Lewis would ask the question, if you ask the world who Jesus is, whom do you say he is? The majority of the world are going to say he was a good man. He was a good man. BJ, that's the only option that Jesus does not allow. You realize that? He does not allow that option. He was either who he said he was, or he was the biggest charlatan and fraud of the entire world history that we know. Either or. You can't have it anywhere in the middle. You can't talk about and place him next to Buddha or Muhammad or Confucius or anything else. That's the only option not allowed. And the book of John will clear that up and proclaim that again and again. The book itself has some of the most beautiful language in it. Jesus' claim in chapter 6, the bread of life. What's the background of the bread of life? I am the bread of life, he said. He had just fed the 5,000. One of the few signs. Do you know, we'll get to this, but he doesn't use miracle in John. He uses signs. There's a bit of a difference. It's all cloudy in our minds, but not in theirs. But he's up on a mountain with this big multitude, and he feeds the 5,000. And then they come, and they will look for him. What did Jesus do? He did another sign. He walked on the water. That's the other sign that's included in the other Gospels. The others from John are not. They're completely standalone. But when they come to him on the other side of the sea, when they finally find him, because they know he didn't go with his disciples, he didn't go into the boat, but he's not anywhere, and they finally cross over, they come around, and now they find him. Hey, where were you? And Jesus is pretty blunt with them. You don't follow me because you saw the signs. You follow me because you ate and your bellies are full. There are religions in this town and across this nation that continue to feed the belly. I watched a clip last night. We were watching that over in the Turks and Caicos and how they celebrated Easter. And boy, they were just jamming out. They were dancing. The music was playing and the drum was banging away. And I suppose it was giving off some kind of praise that you can't imagine what. But here it was, and I thought, wow. Everything centered on the individual, to feed the belly, to feed the mind, to feed the senses. And which one of those things do we read about in the first century church? But that's the way these people were. They were masses of people, and they were praising him, and they followed him, but he was blunt with them. And he said, that's not why you're following me. You're following me because what you think you can get out of me physically. It's like the TV evangelist. You send your money and you'll get blessed financially. And they tell those stories over and over. It's almost like an investment plan. It's like an annuity plan. You just send your money and you're going to get those things. They don't tell you about the spiritual blessings and that, well, maybe you just have to do without, but it'll be for God's purpose. That's not the way they talk. They want to feed their belly. And so Jesus tells them. Of course, they tell him. We'll get through this in the textual part. Why would they say to him that God or Moses, and we'll talk about which one they really mean with the pronoun he gave us manna from heaven. And then Jesus says, Moses didn't give you manna from heaven. God gave you manna from heaven. Why would they be saying that to Jesus? Because they are reinforcing what we just said. If you are who you say you are, take us out of this poverty-stricken state. Moses gave them manna from heaven. He fed them. You feed us and we'll believe. And then Jesus turns the conversation away from the physical like he will again and again and again. So much so that we don't get it today, but he's going to turn it away and he's going to say, I am the bread that came out of heaven. I am the bread of life. And he's talking about the spiritual. When he says, I am the light of the world, John 8, where is he at that point? He's walking. The treasury is there. Where is the treasury? It's in the court of the women. Jesus is hanging out in the court of the women. He's by the treasury. We see that later in the text, further down. Where is the huge candelabra that they light every evening outside the temple? The large candelabra outside the temple is in the court of the women. Now, this isn't in your Bible, I just surmised this, but you can imagine as the shadows grow longer and the day begins to retire and they come out to light the candelabra that shines a light down the hill and could be seen for miles. But Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Not of this place, not of this temple, not of the side, but the light of the world. He says in chapter 10, I am the door of the sheepfold. We don't get that now. We put doors on our sheepfold. There was a commentator that was living back in the 19th century, and he travels over to the Middle East, and he's pretty scholastic, and as he goes there, he's going to investigate some of these things, and he just wants to get a better handle on it. That's why you take a tour of the Holy Lands. So he's riding camels across the desert, and he's going to these places, and he sees all these sheep herders, and he finally goes up, and he asks this one person, he sees a stone enclosure, it's fairly low, and it goes around, and it's a big pen, but it doesn't have any door on it. And he asked the sheep herder, the shepherd there, he says, and we called them goat herders. I didn't see many sheep there. I saw a lot of goats when we were there. But so he asked this person, he goes, well, where's the door? And in the broken English, what did you think the Arab said to him? He goes, I sleep there. I eat. I am the door. That's what the Arab said to him. I'm the door. I don't need a door. I'm right here. And that's something, obviously, that goes back to the first century when Jesus said, I am the door of the sheepfold. If any man would come in, go through Jesus, he could come in and come out and find pasture. I am the good shepherd in chapter 10. My sheep know me, and I know them. There's a relationship that he has with the fold, with the flock, that Peter and the rest of the apostles will talk about later. Can I be saved outside the church? Yes, you can leave the flock, but you've left the good shepherd as well. Later on, he's going to say the true vine. Look at number 7. We're told that denominations are the branches. But that's not what he said. He said, I am the vine and you people are the branches. So if the church that he died for and purchased with his blood is his body, what is the church? It is the vine. Branches are not denominationalism. It is the individuals that are grafted into the vine. And why did he say that? Because physical Judaism was gone. He's talking about the spiritual house of God, as we'll see again and again. Go back up to the resurrection and the life in John chapter 11. What happens in John chapter 11? It's the raising of Lazarus. The critics are going to come to us and say, something so significant and it's not even covered in the other gospels? You got to be kidding me. John's the only one that tells us about this amazing event. That he raises Lazarus from the dead. But do you remember which? I'll tell you what, here's a trick question for you. Which one of the sisters said, if you would have been here, Lord, my brother would not have died? We vote for Martha? We vote for Mary? Actually, both of them say it, right? Both of them say it. In John chapter 11, Martha goes out first. Lord, if you'd have been here, my brother would not have died. He asks her to believe. I do believe. He'll be raised in the last day. There is a resurrection day. I believe. I am the resurrection and the life. And that's the background of that. Number 6 there in John 14, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. We're going to see that in John when we look at major themes. The way, the truth, life, light. Witness. Those are major themes in John. And of course, in John chapter 8, 57 through 59, why do I have that there? That is one of the great I am statements, if not the greatest. It will bring him eventually to the cross. And that is when he is in combat. And we'll see the conflict that starts in chapter 5 and it goes through until he begins to reveal himself to his apostles in chapter 12 or 13, 14, and 15. But he's in combat and starts in 5. But by chapter 8, there is no doubt. So Abraham rejoiced to see my day. Oh, you're not yet 50 years old. Have you seen our father Abraham? Oh, they already knew. They thought, this guy's a quack. He's off his rocker. He's beside himself. We're going to find out his own family thought he had lost his mind. His own family were disbelievers. His own family didn't honor the Savior. And here it is, the Pharisees now, they've got him. Have you seen Abraham? And then he quotes from Exodus. Before Abraham was, I am. No doubt of who he was saying he was. Regardless of the myths of other cults or denominations or churches who would like to paint Jesus in their own portrait. The portrait in John says that he was God, the Word that became flesh and dwelt among us. It was God inserted himself like no other time before history into the history of mankind. The great signs that we read about in John are fewer than the other Gospels. His narrative is somewhat quick, but it has more rich dialogue in it. And a monologue, as you know, from the time of 14 through 17, those four chapters in your Bible, if you have the red letter edition, are all red letter. But there are certain signs, and the sign differs from the miracle. Now, this is somewhat basic, but I want you to understand this a little bit. When we say miracle, we kind of lump every supernatural thing together and say, well, that's a miracle. Well, there's a difference in the Jewish mind. For instance, in Matthew chapter 12, when they ask him about a sign, he said, an evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, but what? No sign shall be given it. You mean you weren't going to do anything, Jesus? You weren't going to show us the power of God? You weren't going to authenticate yourself with a signet, which is what the sign meant? Oh, no, he had done many, but they were still asking for a sign. And what did he say? No sign will be given it, but as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Just like he said in Romans 1 and 4, the greatest sign that he would ever do is resurrection from the dead. In Mark 16 and 20, and they went everywhere, preaching everywhere. They went forth, preached everywhere, and the Lord working with them, confirming the word by the signs that followed. It is a particular emphasis on the proof, the signature, the signet, that this verifies and validates what the individual's saying, where the individual has been, what their claims are. And we know that his witness is true, John says in John 21. That was the reason for the signs. And John gives us seven of these signs. If you look at those right now, I'll just tell you, number 4 is the 4 and 5, walking on the water and the bread and the fish. Those are the only two that are overlapped with the other Gospels. That's interesting, isn't it? Water to wine, nowhere else. John chapter 2. He begins to reveal himself. He also says, what have I to do with thee, when he talked to his mother. And we try to explain that away. We say, well, you know, that probably just didn't mean what it sounds like. I take the other view. I think it's one of the most verifiable things of the gospel writings that these things were written at least 40 to 50 years apart, Mark's gospel to John's gospel, and then Luke and Matthew somewhere in between. By different people, different parts of the world, after different developments. And you know what is so completely consistent besides all the events? The personality of Jesus. Now, I'm no historical mastermind, but if you read, the first thing to go when people begin to make up their own narrative about individuals is they lose the personality. They become inconsistent with the personality of the individual. That never happens in the Gospels. Jesus' personality, whether you kind of like that one or not, it's very consistent. I think that's an interesting little fact, that if you look at it, it's very interesting. Water to wine. Healing of the nobleman's son in chapter 4. Of course, he talks to Nicodemus in chapter 3. Nicodemus is a member of the council who will be reprimanded later as he speaks up for Jesus. But now he goes to him by night. Why? Well, there's three phrases that John uses in his gospel, which tells you a whole lot about what's happening. He says, for fear of the Jews. He uses that phrase three times. For fear of the Jews. Nicodemus comes to him at night. He asks him these things. Jesus says, you know, if you don't know of earthly things, how can I tell you of heavenly things? And the dialogue there is very rich. But then he goes into chapter 4. And where is he in chapter 4? Incidentally, this is another reason why John's gospel is so different. Where did Matthew, Mark, and Luke take place? Most of it. They take place in Galilee. You realize that? Matthew, Mark, and Luke take place in Galilee. Where is the majority of John's gospel taking place? It's the only one we have that's centric on Judea. And when he's not in Judea, part of it in chapter 4, he's in Samaria. So he goes into Samaria, he's talking about the woman by the well, fascinating story. And then in the end of 4, then of course he heals the nobleman's son. And what's interesting about that? He never touches him, does he? He doesn't ever see him. He does it from a distance. Go your way. Son's going to live. He heals him from a distance. The healing of the lame man, this is the beginning of great conflict. He has revealed himself, as we'll find out, one of the divisions of the book is revealing himself to the world in John 1 through 4, and specifically John 1, 19 through chapter 4. When he gets to chapter 5, we begin the conflict where those begin to hate him by healing of the lame man. We talked about bread and fish, chapter 6. He walks in the water, chapter 6, and then the blind man. What kind of conflict begins at chapter 9? The healing of the blind man is the only place it's covered. They take the blind man who now sees, who's been blind his whole life. And what does the Jews do to him? They cast him out of the synagogue. They cast him out of the synagogue because of he can't hardly help himself for who he believes in. Nobody else gave him a sight but that man called Jesus. Well, I'm sorry. You just earned an exit from us. So they cast him out of the synagogue. They excommunicate him. They disfellowship him. And we wonder why the assumptions are made by certain people today. And I was talking to arguing with several atheists just last month. And they had these assumptions. And I asked them again and again. I will submit everything to you and say that you're completely right if you just tell me one thing. I said, what scientific law do you have that gets something from nothing? And I said, and don't talk about E equals MC squared. I said, don't talk about matter and energy changing place. I said, because either way you have energy on one side and matter on the other. I said, what one equation do you have? What one thing do you know about science to get something from nothing? They got so angry for some reason. They didn't want to tell me that. That was a part that the Nova specials that they had been sitting around listening hadn't filled them in on. The blind man, chapter 9. The raising of Lazarus in chapter 11, the only one, the only gospel. And of course, Pharisees hated him so much they had to go and try to kill Lazarus as well. How dare you be raised from the dead? We'll get rid of you and Jesus. Then there's these great statements by others. The great statements by others. I'm going to try to get, fiddling around with my computer now. Nathanael in 149. And of course, he comes out and admits, this is, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God, King of Israel. Just because he said, I saw you standing under the fig tree. He said, oh, you're the Son of God, the King of Israel. Those two titles laid on him in chapter 1. Of course, Jesus turns to him, very interesting. He says, oh, you say these things because I saw you under the fig tree? Oh, Nathaniel, greater things are you going to see than this. He thinks that's pretty small. You're in for the ride of your life. That'll take you to the grave. It'll be much greater than that. And then, of course, the blind man. Jesus asked him, do you believe in the Son of God? Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus says, thou hast both seen him, and he it is that speaketh with thee. And the blind man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. John is a great gospel. It's an interesting gospel that I think we're going to have such a great time with. It's going to be one of those where we just kind of delve into it and let it take us where we go. I pray that you'll get as much out of it as I have already. And as we go along, if there's some questions that some of you have or some of the things that I say, please come up to me and ask me. I'm probably not going to know the answer, but we'll try to find out. And I think we can go through this gospel like we haven't in a while, and that it'll be both inspiring and convicting for all of us. So I appreciate your attention. Thank you so much.